Today's episode will close out Season 5. The show will be on break for 2 months and will resume with fresh new episodes for Season 6 after the Podcast Movement Convention in Chicago in early July. Stay tuned for updates by following me on Twitter at PermatempCorp. That's PermatempCorp. Or find the Permatemp Corporation on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Permatemp Corporation. A presentation of the audio podcast, This Is Actually Happening. Episode 75. What if you were kidnapped by a police officer?
My mom married my dad when I was 5. They got married on Christmas Eve. In the living room with his children there and her children there, and I was considered their child. At the time, I thought he was my dad. I didn't know he wasn't my dad, but he raised me as his own. My dad had a son and a daughter, and my mom had 6 of us. There were 4 boys and 2 girls, and I was the youngest. I was 9 years younger than the next one up, so I was kind of for my mother, I was a late life child. And so for my dad to step in and take me on when his kids were almost out of the nest, that was huge, you know. So he chose to adopt me, and they were older parents, but they were far too loose in that there wasn't enough structure for me. I just made a lot of bad decisions. I was very impulsive. I was a very sexually aware little girl. I knew things way too early in life. I was molested a few times as a child. I honestly don't know how to filter any of that. I don't know how to handle any of it. The earliest one I remember is 3. But I have a feeling there's one that I don't remember that's pretty big, because every once in a while I'll have a dream or something. I wake up with a very bad sense of foreboding, like something's right on the edge of my memory and I don't know what it is. And I think that there's probably a really good reason why I don't remember it. I think for the things I do remember, it would probably destroy me if there's something bigger than those. And then off and on up through the age of 5, I didn't know that sex was a no-no thing, so I remember on one of those, I actually approached the adult and instigated it. The very first one was my mom's best friend's son, who was probably 19, and then there were various other people. One family member, and I've never been able to bring myself to say the words. Like on that one, I can't even say the words. For some reason, I think I was just easy to sniff out because I didn't know that this was wrong. So I just let people do things, or I participated. You know, I was curious and had these feelings I didn't understand. So I allowed myself to be drawn into it. Moving up through time, then I wanted to be popular and I wanted to be one of those girls. I just wasn't one of them. And I wanted desperately to belong. By the time I hit middle school, I just realized I wasn't going to fit in with them. I didn't have the money. So then I found this other alternative crowd that I could be who I wanted to be. Go back to about 1985, and I am 15 years old, and this is in Southern California, so me not really knowing where my place was in life, falling into the goth scene was the closest I can come to really feeling like I was accepted anywhere. And so it was an interesting time of life. I really enjoyed growing up in the 80s. And I find my clique of these kids that don't make the best decisions. And I get to high school and there's this whole world of adulthood and freedom. And then a senior boy introduces me to the notion of that you can ditch school. And then when we did it the first time, it was such a rush. Oh my gosh. Then I found out people were throwing parties during the day. That's awesome. And, you know, it was open campus lunch. No one ever went back after lunch. And if my parents were out of the house, we'd sneak up there and party. And I never showed up to school. And I was supposed to be in honors and advanced placement classes, and I just blew it. Inevitable happened. I got kicked out, sent to continuation school, and then at that point, we had to tell my dad. And my dad at the time was off work on medical leave because he was having he had angina really bad. And at this age, I was in a constant state of fear that he was going to die. He actually went down to the school and he pulled my records and saw all the times I had been truant. He saw my grades and I'd been lying to him saying I was passing, and all the truth came tumbling out. And he came home and he was like, I can't even talk to you right now. And the next day he was in the hospital with a major heart attack. I felt like everything wrong with him at that point I had done to him. So I was beating myself up pretty badly over it. That's a horrible thing to shoulder, because he chose me and then I did that to him. October 31st of 1985, I'm 15 years old. My best friend and her boyfriend and myself, we sneak out and go to this nightclub that's in town. Everybody's there, have a great time. We leave at 2 a.m. and couldn't find a ride home, so we end up having to walk to our house. Her house is easily 5-6 miles away from where we were, so it was a good walk. But it's 2 a.m., so there's really not any cars out. And this one car drives by. He drives by us, and I kind of whoop, hey, or I don't know what I did. I did something stupid. I was a dumb kid. What do I know? And the car put on its brakes. So he pulls up in front of us and stops us and says, excuse me, I need to talk to you. He flashes a badge at us, and he's got like a walkie-talkie on his belt, and it's obviously a police one, because you can hear calls going out for various things. And he says there's been a robbery or something, and one of the perpetrators got away, and they described you to a T. I'm going to need to take you over and have you identified. And I said, I've been there the whole night, and I've been with these two. And he goes, I'm sorry, you don't have I got to take you over to get looked at. And, he said, if it's not you, they won't recognize you and you can go. I remember my friend's boyfriend even said, if you're a cop, why are you driving that? And he's like, I'm undercover. And he flips his badge out. None of us questioned it. None of us questioned it. You're raised to trust law enforcement. You're raised to trust those that are supposed to protect you, and you're supposed to respect those people that say they are the police. No matter how rebellious I was at that time, I never would have even considered saying no to somebody like that. I got in and we start driving, and we're in a residential neighborhood at this point. So, and again, like 2:30 at this point, so it's super quiet. And he said, I'm going to need to handcuff you before I take you onto the scene. He handcuffs me with my hands behind my back. And in the 80s, in the alternative scene, this band Doctor and the Medics had re-released Spirit in the Sky, and they had played it at night. Now, at the time, I was probably atheist, if not agnostic, and I had no religious leanings at that time at all, but I just started singing that song like, gonna go up to the Spirit in the Sky. That's where I'm gonna go when I die. Guitars, drums, everything. It's basically a church song on the radio. I don't know why I'm singing this. We're driving up down the streets and he's making tons of turns, and I lose where I'm at eventually. I'm just thinking, oh my God, I'm gonna go to jail, and my parents are going to find out that I snuck out tonight. I'm terrified of other consequences. He goes, yeah, this is a bad part of town, isn't it? And I said, yeah, that's what I heard. He goes, yeah, you wouldn't want to be out here by yourself. But he's trying to come off as this very understanding middle-aged man, you know, just like a cop, like, okay, I understand. You haven't done this. I know you're not guilty of this. And I'm not going to take you over there because I don't want you getting framed for something you didn't do. But you're going to have to do something for me so I know that you don't go run and tell the first person. And that's like a truck hit me, like, oh, crap. I remember the house we pulled over in front of. It didn't have a lawn, it had white rocks. It was a white rock yard. But I just remember thinking, God, please let someone walk outside. Not like, because I still think he's a cop, so it's not like I think they're gonna stop this, but at least maybe he'll stop out of embarrassment and drive away. I have my hands tried to, you know, on the handle, and I'm trying to think of how I can get out, but then my brain is telling me, even if you get out, what are you gonna do? You know, like, I'm sunk, I'm gonna die. He says, you're gonna do some stuff for me, but I don't want you to worry, I'm not gonna hurt you. Like, he was actually kind of kind about it. And I looked at him and I was like, I don't know what I could possibly do for you. And he said, well, you know, he starts to undo his zipper and I start going, I'm a virgin. I wasn't, because obviously I had a lot of other issues, but I thinking anything I can to get him to say no. He's like, don't worry, I'm not gonna hurt you. Just be quiet, don't make any sound or else I'm gonna have to hurt you and I don't want to. And he said, you're just going to, and he, you know, and I can't even say the words now, not that I'm a prude, but it just horrifies me. I just started crying and he said, no, stop. And he grabbed me by the back of my head and he shoved me down. I just started gagging, and thank God for the gag reflex, because he didn't last more than maybe 2 minutes with me there, because I kept gagging. I think he just was like, oh, this isn't even worth it. And he let me up and he said, now if you tell anybody about this, I'm going to get you put away forever. He goes, I'll frame you with something. And who are they going to believe, you or me? I'm just dying at this point. And then he goes, I don't think I got enough. And he just started fondling me. And, you know, I'm trying to feel the back of the door with my hands. I don't know what to do. I'm panicking. And then I start to really think, oh my God, he's going to kill me. At one point, a truck drove past us and he, like he's a cop, does his official wave thing and he goes, okay, let's go. That thing happening probably saved me a lot more heartache. And we start driving and he was like, no, I don't want you to think you're a bad person. You're not a bad person. And I'm crying and he's trying to talk to me and tell me, oh, don't worry, sweetie, and trying to be really sweet about it. And I think that in itself probably had just as much of a psychological effect on me as anything, because up until this point, I know that sex gets me attention, and that if they have sex with you, then they like you, then they care about you. And that's what that was to me. So to have this guy who is sexually accosting me to say all these comforting things at the same time, it really messes with your sense of what's right or wrong with what can be done to me. And then plus, I think he's a cop. And then plus, I don't think I'm a good person as it is. And he maintained a cop persona through the whole thing. And you know, a good 40 minutes has passed since I left my friends, I think. At least a half hour, probably close to 45 minutes. And to this day, I'm so relieved that they stayed there and didn't leave. So he lets me off about a block away from them. And so I get out of the car, he drives away, and there's nobody out on the road. And the only other soul around is this man in the gas station that's catacorner. So I scream my friend's name. I run across the street and she comes running at me, and we meet at a bus bench. And, you know, just, I'm in her arms, I'm crying. And the guy across the street yells, hey, do you need me to call 911? And she yells, yes. And I yell, no. And she's like, why not? I go, we can't tell. He will have me thrown in jail. I still believe he's a cop at this point. Nothing feels safe after that. We walk home from there, and the sun is actually up by the time we get to her house and get in through the window. Got into the bed, and I just laid there and replayed the whole event over and over and over. You know, she didn't know what she kept telling me. You've got to tell the police. And I was like, no, I can't. I talked to a few friends and I started to hear that this had happened to other people I knew. Same exact situation. Guy saying he's with the police, picks him up, takes him somewhere. And I hear about guys that it's happened to, and I hear about girls that it's happened to, and a lot of them are the people that I hung out with, you know, that go to this same dance club that I was at. He knew that kids like us didn't have anybody that would really listen to them. I think he thought that we were just the ignored kids, so we were safe. Monday went to school, so like a week has gone by now. So Monday I go to school and I went into the office and then I told her what happened. And, you know, she works with some hard kids. I mean, you know, but you just see her face turn white, like, I can't believe what I'm hearing. So she calls the police and they send someone in and they take a report. And then they schedule time for me to go in and talk to two detectives. So I go in and they do this really long interview. And then they interviewed my friend, they interviewed her boyfriend. And I could never shake the feeling that I had done something really bad. Like, this was my fault. I did something bad. The detail that I yelled at the car as it drove by, I felt like that made me culpable for the whole thing. Like, that, if I hadn't have done that, he wouldn't have stopped. So this is all my fault. And I was embarrassed. And so I left that detail out, and the other two said it. And so they kept asking me, did you yell at the car? And I thought, like, they were going to shut the notebook and go, well, that's it. Why'd you do that? You ruined this whole thing. And so I just, you know, looking back, I want to comfort myself, but I just refused to give that information up. I didn't want my dad to know. I thought that would destroy him, and I couldn't handle the possibility of telling him. I imagine as a dad, where you're supposed to protect your daughter, that that's got to be the most powerless feeling in the world, to know that that happened. He didn't need to feel that. They said, okay, fine, but you do have to tell your mother. And I'm still feeling a sense of guilt, like I did something wrong. I told her I didn't want her to come with me to anything. I didn't want her to know anything about it. And I didn't want her to know what happened to me. She didn't need to know the details. She didn't like it, but she agreed with it. And the principal of my school agreed to go as my chaperone for everything. So she just communicated with my mom. A couple weeks goes by. You know, going by the description that all the girls had given, they're trying to figure out, is it somebody that's already in our system? They're bringing pictures for us to look at. And then one day they say, we're going to bring you in for lineup. We think we caught the person. There's like a dozen of us. There's all these girls, and none of them are really older than me. And then there's 12-year-olds in there. A lot of Hispanic girls. Oddly, I am the only one out of that whole gothic alternative group. I'm the only one that called the police on it. And there were boys in that group, and because none of them would come forward, they could never put those things on him too. They have everybody's numbers on the front of them. They walk in, and the second I see him, I know, there he is. I know that face. It was number 5. Well, one girl in the room blurts out, oh my God, it's 5. But I knew it before she said it. That was him. But all of us ID him immediately. And they have to go through this long process of questioning all of us about, when did we know it was him? Did her saying anything influence anything? And all of us just work doggedly to really express, no, this is what we knew. The court trial comes. Then, while he was going through this very publicized court trial, he marries a girl that he knew from high school. And she's got 3 kids, and any chance she gets to talk to the press to tell them, he's a wonderful man. I would trust him with my children. All these girls have got it wrong. They're lying. They can't get their facts straight, which was so outrageous to me. It made me so angry. So it comes time for sentencing, and we all have, you know, he's found guilty, and we all have the opportunity to speak. And I wrote a letter directly to him, and I read it, and I wish I could remember what I said, actually. What I really wish I would have said was, even though you didn't break any bones in my body and they're not visible scars, you've hurt me forever. The scars are so deep that I am irreversibly changed. And I wish I would have said that, because after we were all done giving our statements, the judge gave the sentence, and he said, well, no one, what you did was really bad, but no one had any arms broken or legs broken. Nothing was physically damaged or permanently damaged. And which was a huge slap in the face to this child that doesn't understand how this could happen. in a world that you used to feel safe in, and gave him 9 years with the possibility of parole in 7. I spent 9 years after that counting down how long he would be in, just terrified of when he got out, and not even knowing why, because I wasn't even living in Southern California at that point. Why would I care? But just to know he was free, I think, just freaked me out. My whole life, I have harbored a lot of hatred towards this man, obviously. Before this happened, yeah, due to the lifestyle I was in, I would smoke pot once in a while, or I would get drunk once in a while, but not like this. I would fool around with a boyfriend, but I still had self-respect and I still had boundaries. Afterwards, I can't say something happened that started it. I just stopped having a filter or a line that I wouldn't cross. I became an alcoholic, and not even a good alcoholic, one that would drink to excess, then puke everywhere. Like, I don't know how many weekends I had severe alcohol poisoning without ever once going to a hospital, and didn't even really see a problem with that, or any drugs that I could get my hands on. I was willing to try anything. And if you told me, hey, you know, rat poison gives you a great high, I would have done it. I was just stupid. All bets were off. I was far too promiscuous because I was damaged goods, and I didn't even enjoy it. It was a punishment. Like some girls cut themselves now, I would allow people to do things to me, and it was my way of numbing out, I guess. Anytime somebody had sex with me, I would dig my nails into my palms to try to hurt myself. While I was like, I would punish myself while it was going on, and I would think horrible things about myself. And it probably happened for like 2 years after that. I would allow myself to be punished. I was a bad person in my own mind. You know, I was also really suicidal. I started cutting myself on the wrists a lot. I would have horrible abandonment issues and need to be rescued. Became this drama queen that always needed someone to rescue her or take care of her. And I look back at a very sick child. You know, my dad, I'd given him a heart attack once already, and he was having mini strokes and heart attacks, and we just were terrified of him dying, so we didn't tell him anything going on. Until I finally, one time they had to call because I had taken my mom's medication, and I came out in the living room and I panicked, and I said, I took mom's medication. And I was crying, and my dad was pissed. He had really bad temper, and he dragged me in the bathroom, stuck his finger down my throat, and was like, why would you do this? What? And so he calls 911, and they send an ambulance up, and they were mean to me. Those paramedics were just mean to me. And I was handcuffed to the bed, and it was a cold, hot, I went to the county hospital, which was awful. And I think they were doing that to teach me a lesson. Made me sit there for 6 hours with nothing but a gown on and some socks. After 6 hours of waiting, the psychiatrist says, are you going to do it again? And I went, no. And he goes, okay, go home. That's apparently the screening that they were able to do at the time. Like a few days after that, I went into the living room and talked to my dad for the first time, honestly, and said, I am a messed up person and I need a lot of help, and I'm afraid I'm going to do that again, and I don't want to be like this anymore. So my dad got me into counseling. I got married at 18, had a kid at 19, and tried to become this normal Norman Rockwell mom, wife. I wanted to escape that past that I was, where everything was just so screwed up, and I tried to have a very normal life. My daughter made me grow up, made me think about somebody besides myself, made me live for somebody outside of myself, and changed my mindset about how I should care about myself too. So that, I think, started the very slow healing of who I was. I never addressed what had happened to me, never. Even when I was in counseling, I never addressed that incident. I would bring up other bad things that had happened to me, and there were plenty, but I never talked about that, ever. And it wasn't until I hit about 40 that I realized the scope of what happened to me, too. I never considered I was kidnapped until I was about 40. And then I realized, oh my God, I was kidnapped. I was taken against my will. I was kidnapped. I never allowed myself to think through the entire process until I was about 43. Probably within the last year is when I realized that holding on to that hatred towards him does nothing to, like, I'm punishing myself still. So, you know, I decided to let go of that and forgive him. And, you know, I really realized that forgiving doesn't mean that I approve or that I say it's okay. It's just that I let go of this. And then, oh, probably 3 months ago, one night I had been drinking some wine and I thought about the whole situation through the eyes of a mother. And it just slayed me, like looking at it like a mom to myself, looking at that 15-year-old girl and me as this caring 45-year-old woman that cares about that 15-year-old girl. It's the first time I've looked at that through my adult eyes, feel terrified for myself. And it was painful to really, because I'd never given it that much. My psyche was very good at keeping that away from me. But in the other sense, it was also very cathartic because for the first time, I was able to really let go of that experience. It's not a part of me anymore. It's a history. And I think it makes me a very strong person now. I saw me as a separate person, really. Like, I look at that girl now, and I really don't even feel like she was me. Like, she's just a girl that I know that she had a really, really bad deck stacked against her. But I also see that she's gone, and I'm here, and I've really come a long way. And I, looking back at me then, with all the statistics and the things stacked against me, I never would have imagined I'd be here. And really, to be honest with you, I didn't expect to be alive this long either. To be unhappy and depressed plus take away your sense of safety and that nothing in the world is safe. I never felt safe after that. And I punished myself a lot because I thought I was bad. You take the sense of not belonging and being bad and add to it the sense of there's nothing to ever protect you from bad things that could happen. You know, why live at that? You know, it's a very isolating feeling. Your self-image is that you're bad, so you don't deserve the help. Who would want to live with that on their shoulders? And I would wake up each day just so depressed that I woke up again. It was like, ugh, I'm here again. A lot of that had to do with the fact that I just had no one I could trust. And I really felt that I would spend my entire life with that feeling. I had allowed him to make me a huge victim, you know, and I gave him that power, and I know that now. You know, I've got this great, amazing life. I've got great possibilities in my future. And that man has nothing in his future. He's always going to be monitored. No one will ever trust him. Yeah, he lives in a really crappy apartment in a bad part of town. His life is gone. I found out at one point that his brother was also arrested for molesting a bunch of Boy Scouts. Like, both of them were damaged, which tells you they were probably molested as children. You feel bad that this cycle happened to them, that just completely ruined their lives and ruined everybody else's life that they touched. Like, everybody was damaged by this. Being a teacher now is, I know that there are some kids that need just one adult in their life that they're safe with. And I know that there are a lot of kids that I'm that one adult with. This is the weird part of all of it, is that I think that happened to me for a reason. I don't believe in accidents, and I believe I had to go through that because somebody needed me to be this person now. And I needed to understand and overcome all that so that I could be who I am now. And so I actually think I was supposed to have that happen to me. And I know a lot of people would probably think that was just the biggest load of shit they'd ever heard in their life, but I really honestly believe that though. Like, I think that somebody had to go through it to help others, and somebody knew that I would be able to overcome it eventually. There is pre-30 and then there's post-30, and those are the two lives I've had. You know, that marriage didn't last, but I don't regret it because it did help me out of a very difficult time of my life. It served as a doorway. I was 27, 28, and then at 29 I met my current husband, and I felt very fulfilled and comfortable closing a door to who I was. Since I've turned 40, I've actually even grown even more from there, because now I can honestly say that I'm not a victim. Those things don't hurt me. I feel sorry for that little girl, but I don't feel like it's me anymore. So I don't feel that sense of pain. And none of it's a secret. Half of my life before 30 is a huge secret, and the things I can't talk about, but I can't say that about anything since the age of 30. it informs who I am, but now I realize it doesn't define who I am. And it's a story that happened to this other girl that I know intimately, yeah. And I never in a million years, like never, ever, ever did I ever think that I would ever come to that place where I could forgive. You are not good, you are not bad, you are you. And when things happen to you, you are not the thing that happens to you. In fact, I wouldn't even say you're the way that you responded to it defined you. None of that defined you. Let go of that because it's a prison. It's a horrible prison to live in. And the second that you willingly let go of that and say, you know what? No, it frees you and you can start to like yourself then. Nobody got me over that. I had to want it for myself. I'm not a victim to events. I'm a participant in them. They don't take control over me. I take control of my story. It's my story to tell. And I didn't let him be the ending of my story.